Hello and welcome back to Millennial 8. I apologise for the delay. This stream was supposed to start an hour ago, but I was, the previous stream went on longer than I expected. So nonetheless, I'm now here with Paul Fahrenheit. So Paul, welcome to Millennial, and would you introduce yourself to the audience?
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Woes. Can you hear me all right?
Absolutely.
Outstanding. Well, thank you very kindly for extending the invite to me. It's been a great pleasure and an honor to come on to Millennial. Something I've watched many times going back many years, and it's very much a pleasure to finally get the chance to be on the other side of the screen. And so I greatly appreciate you extending the opportunity. It says down there in the little box in the bottom right, but not the corner. It says I'm an American content creator, and that's pretty much about it. I mean, I don't have any other titles. I don't have anything that credential wise that like differentiates me from any other dude who's on Twitter or on live streams or anything like that talking. But you know, I write. I have a Substack. It's called the Fahrenheit Family Archives. People can find it if they Google it. But I'm mostly there just kind of discourse about various topics that catch my fancy and interest. The primary one of which being America and its place in the destiny of the world, the destiny of the West, and things outside of the West. So that's kind of primarily where I'm coming from. You know, I've written something in every single genre that you could write on Substack. I've written poetry, short stories, nonfiction, creative nonfiction, historical essays with sources and research and stuff like that. So I don't really limit myself to any one genre. I think everything, as long as it's the written word or the spoken word, can very easily enlighten the sort of topics I'm going towards. That's kind of my content in a nutshell. Me in a nutshell, I'm a younger man, joined the United States military, was attached to the 82nd Airborne Division. During the fall of Kabul, watched the fall of Kabul happen I wasn't in Kabul, just so you know. I watched it happen from a intelligence shot perspective, because that's what I was providing support for. Graduated from university with a history degree. I've worked in a couple of interesting industries that gave me a couple of interesting insights into America, into the world, into how things work. So that's kind of my background in a nutshell. I will say this though. I have been, I'm a younger man, I have been, writing, consuming, understanding, political and dissident content since I was about maybe 16 years old. And I went to college just specifically to study stuff like that. So that's kind of the one thing I'm sort of proud of that I've done thus far, is that this has been my entire adult life. So that's kind of me in a nutshell.
All right. Just to be clear, when you say you saw the fall of Kabul, do you mean in 2021?
Yes, in 2021.
Right. Okay. I was just wondering.
Right place, right time, right security clearance.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, I'm not going to ask you any questions about that because security reasons. But that must have been quite an incredible thing to see.
Yeah, I don't mean to interrupt. I apologize. It kind of came at the exact same time as the vaccine mandate in the military came, but they're revoking it. So I thought I was going to get discharged, but it appears they will be keeping me in for the remainder of my contract.
All right. Well, the fall of Kabul, and I've talked about it, I've mentioned it several times already on this Millennial, that the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan seems to bode badly for America as a world power. But then stuff that's happened since then, there seems to be life in it yet. What would you say about Afghanistan, broadly speaking? That obviously, without breaching your security.
Well, there's nothing I can say, and there's nothing I haven't said that isn't publicly available information. You know, the one of the things people who've worked inside the intelligence community can kind of tell you is that most everything that people talk about is just publicly available information. The only like actual classified information that gets you in trouble is numbers and stuff, numbers and specific coordinates and stuff like that. So as long as I speak generally, no one really cares. And I'm not going to go too much into stuff that would get people in trouble. But regardless, yeah, it was a very interesting experience. I mean, you know, I saw a general breakdown of the high command at pretty much all levels. You know, I saw everything from like on the ground command to regional command to all the way up into the Pentagon just kind of fail to make a decision. But that's kind of because in many respects, the Afghanistan and Iraq war, even though they loom large in our memories as these grand sort of pointless conflicts a la Vietnam, Vietnam was completely justified as a geopolitical conflict. You know, America had a geopolitical enemy in the Soviet Union contesting the country of Vietnam, which was a country within our sphere of influence. And therefore, you are entirely within your rights to oppose that with military force. Vietnam was a completely justified thing. Afghanistan and Iraq were kind of imperial expansion wars, which is funny because one of the things I always say is that the global American empire is kind of like how Voltaire said about the Holy Roman Empire. It's not global, it's not American, and it's not an empire. It looks a lot more like Carthage than like Rome did. And that's my thing with the current, you know, iteration of what you would call the American system and the UN and all of that. But no, I mean, Afghanistan and, you know, and Iraq and those wars, what we would call the Great War on Terror, the GWAT. The thing about that is it's like I kind of liken it to when Caligula ordered his legions to just march into the sea and start stabbing the water. That's about as much sense as it made in retrospect. And I understand that like in the early 2000s, the neocons kind of wanted to go off and use our big post-Cold War military to hit some people with and to like, you know, flex muscles or whatever. But it's like, you know, The logic of civilization demands that if you don't have any external threats, you decrease the size of your military and use those resources for something else. You don't just go out and find an excuse to use this massive military that you built over 50 something years of arms race with another world superpower. So, you know, I always figured that, you know, Afghanistan was going to end in some sort of shit show, but I didn't expect it to be as bad as it ended. But at the same time, it's like people, as is often the case, a lot of people will read too much into any one event. You know, the fall of Kabul, it, you know, I saw it from a God's eye view basically. And it was screwed up and a lot of bad stuff happened there. But really at the end of the day, it was just kind of, it's just a blunder. People make blunders, empires make blunders, nations make blunders, and a blunder, a decline does not make. But I'm not saying that a decline isn't happening. I'm just saying perhaps people ought to not bet against the American military as easily. Because trust me, I have as many problems with it as the next guy. The thing is it's like it's still the greatest fighting force on earth, and as the recent conflict has proven, it can still punch, you know, far outside of its weight and influence. But that's kind of my synopsis of the whole thing.
So, what would you say about America's, you know, from your perspective, and obviously this I would ask you to draw on not just your military experience here, what would you say about America's status as a superpower? Do you think it's as secure as it was? Do you think it's going downhill? What do you think? Well, what's your perspective there?
So I don't mean to, you know, I'm a bit of a dissident within dissidents when I say that I believe the United States is going to last for at least the next 800 years. I don't even believe that the United States has hit halftime yet. I think we're just getting started. And I have a couple of reasons for believing that. And I'm not saying this because I like what's going on. You know, I have the Anon AVI as all of you do. I have the problems with the pause like all of you do. So trust me, I share your gripes, especially the cultural gripes. Shit, I mean, I was going to get discharged for the vaccine mandate. You know, it is what it is. But, you know, my thing with it is that the United States just has quite literally everything. Mr. Woz, have you ever played a video game like Civilization, something like that?
No, I haven't. That was after my time.
Okay. Well, there's this video game I grew up playing called Civilization V. There's, you know, earlier versions. I'm sure the old heads are calling me a very young, you know, kid who doesn't know what he's talking about, or, you know, Age of Empires or something like that. And there are, you know, you could, every so often you will get this just godlike start. All of the resources are next to you. You've got the perfect land to start building farms and all this other stuff, and you just start snowballing really quickly. In real life historical terms, that's essentially what happened to the United States. The continental United States are probably the best piece of land on the planet Earth for a couple of reasons. Reason number one, the United States has more miles of inland navigable waterway than the rest of the world combined. If you ever look at the Mississippi River and all of its tributaries, it looks like this one massive tree. You can sail in.
I couldn't believe, like, one time, just sorry to
interrupt. Go ahead.
This is relevant. I can actually say something on this. I go through, like, once a year, I go through an autistic obsession with film locations, specifically the showdown of RoboCop. It was filmed at a place in Pennsylvania, a town called Monessen, a steel mill in Monessen, Pennsylvania, which doesn't exist anymore. But it was on this river. Hold on a second. It comes off the... let me see. Yes, the Monongahela River. I've no idea.
One of the proposed names of the state of West Virginia. Keep going.
Yeah, and so I developed this obsession. I start looking at old photos of this steel mill, try to work out the relation between different bits of it and all that kind of stuff. And it's on this river. And the last time this obsession took me, I one night started. Just, I thought, what is the river? How big is this river that it's right next to the steel mill? And because it's Americana, you know, it's like these steel mills and different types of factories were built next to rivers, next to train lines, and train lines were built to service them and all that. So anyway, I was wondering about this river. So I started following it on Google Maps. It just goes on and on and on and on and on and on, unbelievably. And it keeps bending and turning round. It's like spaghetti. It's absolutely massive. Mm-hmm. And eventually it becomes the Ohio River, I think.
Yep. It becomes the Ohio, and then the Ohio feeds into the Mississippi. And the Mississippi goes all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. You are correct. It's like, you know, and it's not just those rivers. It looks like one massive tree of just all of these rivers just going out into what we would call the Great West, from the city of New Orleans down on the coast of the Gulf of Mexico all the way up to Minneapolis in Minnesota to Chicago on the Great Lakes. And, you know, through the Great Lakes, you can get onto the St. Lawrence and go out into the Atlantic Ocean or through the Erie Canal and the Hudson and go out that way. So basically, everywhere that wasn't connected, we built canals to connect. And so the United States has people don't understand this. One of the industries I've worked in that I draw a lot of experience from is actually logistics and supply chain. And it wasn't until I worked in that industry that I realized that quite literally everything depends on the movement of goods from one place to another. And the movement of goods from one place to another is easiest done over water. Right, over water, it is up until this day it's the fastest, it is the most reliable, it is the highest stress infrastructure that any nation can have. You can put more goods on a barge and float it up a river faster than you can put on a truck, than you can put on a plane, than you can put on even an ocean going ship. And
this is relevant to Britain as well, because we also have a canal system.
Yes,
it was I think entirely artificial. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, I do believe that it's going to become relevant. Right now, and for the last 100 years or 150 years, the canal system has been a sort of antiquated thing. It was immediately superseded by the railway system. Mm-hmm. But I suspect that it's going to start being used for freight again at some point in the future. It wouldn't surprise me.
Well, and it's not even so much that it's antiquated, right? Think of it as more of like the bottom part of a pyramid, and the rail is the next part of a pyramid, and then the road is the next part of a pyramid, and then the air freight is the next part of a pyramid at the top of it. It's just none of it gets stopped using, but the presence of the previous thing makes it possible to build that more complexly. And I'm glad you brought up England and Britain, because the reason England industrialized the way it did was because of those, one of the several reasons, of course, but what made it easy to transport coal from Wales to factories in Manchester and Birmingham and London, what made it easy was the fact that you had all of these inland waterways that were then just replaced by rails because it was easier. What they realized how to work steam engines, and they figured they could do it easier and cheaper that way. But it's the same case that happened with Germany too. The reason Germany industrialized as quickly as it did was because it had more more rivers across its territory and interlinked than any other territory in Europe. Same thing with Belgium, which is the most densely industrialized part of Europe. But the United States takes that about 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 levels higher. It's just the scale of it is so much larger simply due to nature, simply due to the results of ecology. And so that's primarily reason number one. It's just the United States has a natural infrastructure in which it can easily distribute all of the goods produced inside of it to itself to the point where it's completely self-sufficient. Reason number two, I believe the United States will last for probably at least another 800 years. It's got the Midwest. The Midwest is the most fertile farmland in the world. You can grow more food on it faster and safer and without depleting the soil, just simply due to the natural. I don't know so much about ecology. All I know is that there's a process that occurs in the Midwest, which basically contiguously replenishes the nutrients in the soil around it so that you can basically keep just growing these massive crops of wheat and corn. And I hate Monsanto and the big food and, industrial agriculture as much as the next guy. Right. But this is just a fact. These are facts that exist. And this is just natural advantages. I'm not even getting into the infrastructure we've built or the fact that the Texas Triangle alone, the Texas Triangle, if you're not familiar, is the city of San Antonio, Dallas, Fort Worth, and Houston in Texas, making a big triangle. The city of Austin is on the one of the sides of that triangle, making a triangle between each other. And that is the region that produces the second most heavy industrial machinery on Earth. The first most is the entire country of Germany, and their industrial sector has been greatly shrinking due to their lack of availability of energy. So Texas is probably going to be the world's leading producer of heavy industrial machinery in the next couple of years. In addition, the United States has all of its energy needs within its own borders: petroleum, natural gas, nuclear, solar and wind. Much of it, I hate solar and wind, but like basically the United States, to say nothing about our Navy, which is the strongest in the world, about our Air Force, which is the first and second strongest in the world, about our ground forces, about our advanced tech sector, about the fact that we're the center of world finance, about that the fact that, I could keep listing these things, but basically that's in a nutshell why I think the United States is here to stay. Right? Matter of fact, the United States has it so good compared to the rest of the world in so many respects that we sit here and all that's left to fight over is culture and just completely degenerate into ourselves and to do these terrible displays of absolute filth and a subhuman morality. All right. So it's like, I'm not saying this prosperity is a good thing. It's just a fact. And so that's kind of like a couple of the reasons why I believe that the United States will not cease to exist for a very long time.
I mean, I could these are relevant factors, and I could understand these natural resources being valuable, being useful. Mm-hmm. But the question would be, will they be useful to an entity called the United States of America for the next 800 years, or will they be useful to some other powers?
Well, that's true. And I mean, that's when you start getting into things. And this is on Odyssey, right?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Lovely. I'm not used to this.
Just no racial slurs. I've got to think about the UK hate speech laws.
No, I understand. Yeah. I understand. Yeah. I mean, I can speak a little bit freer here though, than I normally would. I'm not going to say anything that'll get you arrested. I don't intend to do that. Those forces are a factor for sure. I mean, one of my big intellectual influences is Francis Parker Yockey. Yockey kind of talks about what he calls this sort of culture distortion. And that's a euphemism for a certain group and or groups of people. That's certainly a thing, and that's certainly a problem we are dealing with, right? And that is the great struggle. And we wouldn't be here if that wasn't causing any sort of massive conflicts and difficulties and just general decline and rot. But at the same time, the United States is the 800-pound gorilla in the room that's gonna continue being the 800-pound gorilla in the room It's just right now, you know, someone's, I don't mean to use a comic book reference, but someone's like thrown a mind control device over its head or whatever. And it's now rampaging in favor of the person who controls it. But it's like, you get rid of that mind control device, you still got the 800-pound gorilla. It's just, what else is it going to be used for now? So that's the way I look at it is, yeah, the United States may be hijacked, may be under occupation, you know, without even realizing it by certain groups. But it's like, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here and consign the entire United States to the flames, because the United States is very much a within the continuity of Western and European culture, of art, of literature, of philosophy, of systems of economics, of mathematics, of warfare, of names, of blood, of genealogies, of religions. The United States is a European country in many ways, or at least it was founded by it, and its culture still is. We're still speaking English. We're still speaking English with each other.
Yeah, and the DNA, I mean, the genes are mostly German and English. That is a fact. Now, in terms of white Americans, I mean, white Americans are European. You know, I'm not averse to this. You know, there are some people from the old world who don't like this idea, but I mean, it's clearly true that America. Question. I mean, it's just the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's the, in many ways, the ethnic Americaners or old stock Americans has been coming into vogue as of recent. You know, they're the strongest tribe in the West right now. They're the ones with the biggest stick. And in many ways, they still keep the lights on and they still keep the country running. And I part of me wishes that they would realize the power that they had. Not that they should just bring the whole thing down, but rather that they should just simply start acting within their own interest. That's my big thing. I just wish Americans would just start acting within their own interest. Ethnic Americans who have a bigger claim to this country than almost anyone else. Like let me give you an example, Mr. Woes, and this kind of actually segues into the topic I wanted to come onto here to talk about. You know, my family on both sides came to the United States in the 1700s. They came to the United States, my mom's side, 1714. My dad's side, 1723. So, you know, we were here. We weren't here for Jamestown or anything like that, although I can tangentially trace something back to Jamestown. I'm from Virginia, for those of you who don't know. The oldest and longest settled state in the United States. And actually, if you ever come and visit it and you go to the old colonial towns, in many ways, it kind of looks like, it almost looks like England in that respect, not just in the towns, but in the mountains that surround it, the hills, the forests, it's the stone walls on either side of a sunken road. It's something. It very much is. But, you know, the United States, the history of the United States begins in 1607. That's when the United States begins, when John Smith and the Virginia Company settled the town of Jamestown, which could be characterized as basically a mining colony set up by a multinational conglomerate staffed by mercenaries. That's the foundation of the United States right there in 1607. And, you know, from there, everything else came. You know, New England was settled in... I think 1623 was when it was settled, when the pilgrims arrived there. And you've got all these little things started up independently. You know, America actually in many ways was founded in the wake of the English Civil War. You know, David Hackett Fisher in his book Albion Seed outlines this better than I could. That's the thing to go check out is Albion Seed. But basically the United States was just England too. It was actually England's issues with itself being played out over a much wider scale. You know, to paint a very, very, very broad brush, the Puritans and the Cromwellite parliamentarians went and settled New England and Boston and that area, and the sort of cavalier high Tories and the moderates went and settled Virginia and started the Old South and all that. And they had their fights and their disputes, but they all had a common cultural background. They all had a common cultural background. America came into existence. It was born. It had its ethnogenesis during the English, the Elizabethan, specifically Golden Age. And specifically, America centered itself around three texts. you know, which yes. which you said, those three texts being...
This was going to be the basis of this stream. So it's nice. You've nicely segued to that. The three texts were Milton, Paradise Lost, I would guess, Shakespeare, and the King James Bible.
Yes. So all three of those are, you know, I'd say in common, the three greatest works that have ever been written in the English language. The King James Bible is unequivocally the most influential text ever been penned in the English language. That's just a fact. Whether or not you are Christian, the structure of the English language, the way we use the English language was in many ways decided by the printing of the King James Bible. You know, Milton's Paradise Lost is the single most aesthetically brilliant work in the English language. It's better than any one work Shakespeare put out, but you know, Shakespeare almost summoned into being this sort of glorious, illustrious past that you could argue, you know, while it may have existed in some ways or another, it wasn't given the luster it had until Shakespeare is the greatest writer who ever existed in English, brought into being with his plays, his poems, his prose, and all of these other things. And those were the three texts that were circulating when America was in its nascent foundational stages, and what set the stage for what America would see itself as in the continuity of Europe. So that's kind of the synopsis why I point to those three texts. And each of those three texts actually serve a different role.
Well, let's talk about that then. I'm not an expert on, any of those three texts, unfortunately. But, I mean, in terms of Shakespeare, I know Macbeth. Mm-hmm. I know Romeo and Juliet, The Merchant of Venice, and... and there's another one that's I know Hamlet well. Mm-hmm. So I'm familiar, and not as familiar as I would like to be, but I mean, this is, you know, I just in the previous stream I was saying that I don't think schooling is I don't think it's the best way that we could be spending 13 years of a child's time.
As a product of the American public school system, I have to agree with you.
But I do really, I'm very grateful for the fact that I was introduced to Shakespeare. And when I think about, you know, those 13 years of schooling, you know, especially high school, it was basically a waste of time, except for Shakespeare. And I don't say that with any sort of pretension. As I've said, I'm not claiming to be an expert on Shakespeare. I'm just saying this stuff really does seem to matter. Mm-hmm. This stuff really did make an impression. This stuff really did enrich my life. This stuff really does matter a lot to me personally. And so, I mean... Well,
let's get started with Shakespeare. We've got three texts to go through. You know, we're talking about Shakespeare. Let's get started with Shakespeare. You know, for those of you who don't know William Shakespeare, he was born in Stratford-upon-Avon. He is the only important thing that ever happened in Stratford-upon-Avon. And you know, he was he wasn't really a noble. He was kind of like just this country bumpkin almost who wasn't really inside of, and I'm by no means a Shakespeare scholar, so take everything I say with a grain of salt. But you know, he was outside of the cities, which were very much booming at this time, where you know, writers like Ben Jonson and Thomas Marlowe and all the other great playwrights who are great English writers that, you know, should also be read, but they're just not Shakespeare. But he was outside of them, and he wrote plays mostly for money, mostly to keep his living. And it kind of, it's one of the funniest things ever that the greatest literary mind I think that ever existed had such a just pool of talent just gifted to him from the outset that you could characterize it as his wife, you know, walks in and is like, "Well, Bill, it's rent's due next month, so time to write another epic shattering poem that just completely revolutionizes the way people understand the English language." He's like, "Yes, dear." And then in like 2 weeks, he writes out, you know, The Merry Wives of Windsor or something like that, that's still read, you know, 400 years later. But to give, you know, the audience an example as to what I mean, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm going to read my favorite little speech that happens in any Shakespeare plays, and it actually happens on the first page of Act One of Julius Caesar, read out by Flavius. All right, Marullus. Flavius and Marullus are two tribunes of the plebs walking around, and all of these citizens of Rome are celebrating. You know, Caesar's coming back. He's just beat Pompey in the civil war. Flavius and Marullus are kind of chastising these citizens, and Marullus says this. He says, "Wherefore rejoice? What conquest brings he home? What tributaries follow him to Rome to grace in captive bonds his chariot wheels? You blocks, you stones, you worse than senseless things. Oh, you hard hearts, you cruel men of Rome. Knew you not Pompey? Many a time and oft have you climbed up to walls and battlements, to towers and windows, yea, to chimney tops, your infants in your arms, and there have set the livelong day with patient expectation to see great Pompey pass the streets of Rome. And when you saw his chariot but appear, have you not made an universal shout that Tiber trembled underneath her banks to hear the replication of your sounds made in her concave shores? And do you now put on your best attire? And do you now call out a holiday? And do you now strew flowers in his way that comes in triumph over Pompey's blood? Begone! Run to your houses, fall upon your knees, pray to the gods to intermit the plague that needs must light on this ingratitude." That's my favorite little speech that happens of any Shakespeare's plays, where basically Marullus, this tribune of the plebs, is telling all of these celebrating peasants who are celebrating Caesar coming back, and he says to them, you remember when Pompey was this great general who went out and conquered the world and brought everyone under him and, you know, brought glory to Rome, and you sat there waiting expectantly for him to come back to bring you news of great victory, and now you celebrate his death because Caesar destroyed him just because he's the man of the moment. That's the sort of an example of something that makes Shakespeare sort of the greatest writer who had ever written in English.
Well, I mean, there's obviously so much that could be said here. Examples of incredible soliloquies and speeches, paragraphs like that, that make a point, but make it in the most ridiculously good way. That's beautiful. That's penetrating. Insightful. And it works so well. I mean, the talent, as you said, is just incredible. Mm-hmm. This is why, you know, even, you know, I was like 14 when I read Romeo and Juliet at school. We studied it, and you know, I wasn't into that kind of thing. As you would expect, it's not the kind of thing that you, teenage boy, ordinarily gets into. But the quality of the writing was just. It just carries you. It carries you right into it, and you cannot help but love it.
Yeah.
You know, because he does things. He encapsulates things with such beauty and such clarity, and such a turn of phrase, and there's so much understanding involved as well. It's not just that he's articulate; it's that he has apparently done an incredible amount of thinking about human nature and what it is to be alive. What it is to be a human being, in different stations as well. They're male and female, young and old, rich and poor, everything.
Titled and landless.
Absolutely. He's thought about all of these things. It's such an incredible surveying of human nature.
Well, and in addition, go ahead, finish.
No, go on.
Well, I wanted to put forth too, is that like, in my opinion, and this is my opinion, all right, so the members of the audience are free to disagree with me at will. I believe, you know, the different peoples, the different tribes of Europe specifically, have one trait that makes them unique. That's their one expression that you know, while maybe other peoples have it, they don't have it to the same extent or the same sort of genius that, you know, the other tribes have. And for the English people and, you know, to an extent the American people, the English-speaking peoples, I guess you could say, as a whole, the one trait that they have that, you know, Shakespeare is sort of the greatest exemplar of is empathy. there's a reason that the English are always the best historians. They're always the best understanders because, you know, Englishmen have written histories about every single culture on the planet Earth. They've founded whole museums to found every single culture on Earth, whether it's worthy or it's not, because it is the feeling of the English people that is exemplified by Shakespeare to simply understand how your fellow man is, what he is, what he suffers, what he lives through, what he understands, and from a perspective outside of your own. And I'm not saying other peoples don't have that. You know, I'm not saying other tribes don't have that.
It's something that's specifically expressed by the English. I would agree. I mean, I thought you were going to say storytelling, not empathy.
Well, storytelling is just a follow-on of empathy. It's sort of understanding. It's understanding a situation and telling something with a twist and a moral at the end of it.
Yes, yeah, and structuring it in such a way as to make a point. I mean, this is something that I've been getting into as well lately. I mean, I've always done creative writing in my younger life, but I've been resuming it recently in the middle of this year, and it's great fun. But one of the challenges is you can come up with a character, you can come up with a basic concept of a situation, but then what's the plot? What happens when you press the play button? What's going to actually happen? That's a whole thing in itself. It's actually very difficult to decide on that kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, you know, this is, once again, this is just my opinion. You know, everyone is free to disagree with me, but that's what I think is at least unique about the English speaking peoples. But you know, what's unique about Shakespeare and what the role that the texts of Shakespeare sort of give to America and to England in many respects, because America is simply this snapshot of England taken at the Elizabethan golden age and then taken in another direction. You know, what Shakespeare gives is the pagan past. That's what he gives. He gives you this sort of grand narrative of what this people, being the English people, is, the English speaking peoples, you know, whether it be the St. Crispin's Day speech, whether it be, Othello, even though it was Othello the Moor, you know, calling back to these medieval figures of England that he based the play off of, whether it be all of these other plays, that still call back to this inherent character of the English people and where they come from. And why they came into being and how they came into being and where they draw their sort of legendary lineage from. That's what Shakespeare gives. He gives this pagan past, you know, almost, you know, even though all of his plays, you know, they have references to Christ and all of that, you know, Shakespeare has some of the most pagan plays ever. Like, A Midsummer Night's Dream. Come on. That's one of the most pagan things you could ever read and experience, was the play. And you know, there's all nymphs and fates and fairies and spirits in all of his plays, you know, that are ostensibly Christian. And that's what he serves. He gives you this pagan past, this great history, this story that you are in continuity of.
That is a good point. And, you know, I was thinking about Macbeth there and The Tempest, which is another one that I'd really like to know well. But with Macbeth, with the witches,
The Tempest is Shakespeare's single greatest work.
Well, I'll bear that in mind. See, there are others like Coriolanus. And King Lear. I know Titus Andronicus just because of I saw the adaptation made in the late 90s, which is it's actually very well done, but it's a horrifying play. I mean, the stuff that happens in it is awful. But yeah, I can see the point you're making. Now, as for Midsummer Night's Dream, I always avoided it because I don't like the comedies. But I am familiar with characters like Bottom and all of that stuff. Oh no, hold on, was that Twelfth Night? Hold on, let me see this. let me see.
My personal favorite has always been
it was Midsummer Night's Dream. Right. Okay.
Sir Falstaff. He's always my I'm probably pronouncing all of these wrongs. I apologize. But Sir Falstaff, I suppose, has always been my my personal favorite comic relief character. And actually, in Henry IV, he's actually the great challenge that Henry has to overcome. Henry has to sort of leave Sir Falstaff behind and grow into this, stop being this degenerate alcoholic and grow into this rightful heir to this kingdom. And actually Henry V, when it begins with the death of Sir Falstaff, and Henry actually becomes he becomes the king that he was supposed to be. And then he goes forth and he leads England to victory over France of this Hundred Years' War that he grew up in the shadow of. That's one of the other great sort of moments of Shakespeare, of what he's kind of talking about, is that like these characters change. They change. And here's the other thing too, right? This is another thing people don't understand. Like he brings life to everything he writes about. When you think about the life and death of Julius Caesar, you think about Shakespeare's version. That's the version in your head. You know, he doesn't, you know, we have no record of him saying et tu, Brute, but we all imagine that that's what he did. You know, when you think of Henry V, you think of Shakespeare's version. The King was literally just the Netflix movie. It was just a recapitulation of the Shakespeare play. You know, everything that Shakespeare wrote about, you think of his version. And the things he didn't write about, you Shakespeareize, you know, and, and that's kind of the whole thing to take away, is that Shakespeare is the, more than anything else, invented this idea of dramatic history, of dramatic sort of like looking at the past the way you would look at anything. You know, you would look at any of these great stories, and he's the one who brought it into the English language. And and America had that very much in their mind. All of the founding fathers of America, and even before them, you know, their precursors. For example, the individual who's in my profile picture is William Byrd II. William Byrd II, you know, came from the Byrd family. They were a you know, middle class family in England. They were artisans, I believe, that kind of came into money as part of the gentry, which is another very important thing when thinking about the founding of America. The idea of the gentry, which is a uniquely English concept, this sort of niche between the merchant and warrior caste, which was filled by the gentry, that people of low birth but high talent could sort of achieve standing in society. And they later become what we call the middle class now. But, you know, William Byrd II was one of these sort of gentry figures. He becomes one of the first, you know, what you would call Southern aristocrats. He comes to Virginia. He builds Westover Plantation. He is a member of the Royal Society. He practices law in England. He does all of these other things, but he's always bouncing back and forth between England and Virginia, where he attempts to run for governor and fails. He surveys the border between Virginia and North Carolina. And basically he's just sort of this, like this ideal of like this 18th century sort of polymath, this frontiersman. And I apologize. I had some way I was connecting this to Shakespeare, and some way I was connecting this to the foundation of America. I apologize. The founding fathers. Yeah. And William Byrd was very much like, had Shakespeare known by heart, right? Had like the other founding fathers, had Shakespeare known by heart. They were taught it from a very young age. It was one of the foundational texts, along with the Greek and Latin classics they read. They all read Shakespeare. And actually segueing, they all read Milton. They all read Milton. So to say, some people like to say Shakespeare was sort of, if they look at the English Civil War, Shakespeare, he wrote his last plays about, I don't remember the exact dates of the English Civil War. I want to say maybe 50 years before the English Civil War, in the early 1600s. A quick Google search will fix it. I apologize. I don't remember dates very well. I'm a terrible historian. Yeah, Shakespeare is writing about a half century before the English Civil War. But in Twelfth Night, which you bring up earlier, he actually predicts this sort of Puritan mindset that would lead to it. And Milton is actually the epitome of that Puritan mindset. Because keep in mind, America was founded in many ways with Puritan principles and Puritan peoples. You know, this idea of this perfect godly city on the hill. You know, this epitome of specifically this English this English Calvinist confession of Christianity, where we can purify ourselves of all sins now, and as long as we keep this strict and disciplined enough way. And you know, this was primarily in the New England colonies, in Massachusetts Bay, in, you know, to extent Connecticut and other places like that. This kind of became the dominating sort of theological and cultural outlook. And it kind of got turned up to 11 during what we call King Philip's War. King Philip's War was basically, there was this Indian chief, I forget his name, I think the Narragansetts was his tribe. And they called him King Philip. That was his English name. And he basically whips up the all of the native tribes of New England into what is quite literally a race war between the red Indians and the white settlers in New England. And this is the one time in pretty much all of American history, although you have similar things that happened in Virginia in the 1600s, where actually the natives stood a chance of winning. In many ways, the natives outnumbered the white settlers. Their technological advantages that the European settlers had weren't really that big of a deal, you know, to the point where basically the Puritan New Englanders were killing the converts, the native converts to Christianity, because the native converts, when they would let them in, would start going on rampages and start killing people within the walls of these cities. So when it got to the point where you were killing your own converts, that lends itself to a certain mindset of paranoia, of perfectionism, of discipline, of, you know, to an already strict and paranoid and disciplined people.
Yes, indeed.
And so that kind of leads to this sort of, you know, this sort of arch Puritanism, almost, you know, it's the component that leads to this American evangelizing, is the best way to say it. That's kind of what it's known for, is now America is the most evangelizing country on earth. We love spreading everything, whether it be at first Christianity, at second democracy, and as some people say now, the pause, although I think that's far more brittle and it will end itself far quicker than a lot of other people think, but I digress. And Milton, John Milton, who wrote Paradise Lost, which is an epic poem, is the greatest of these sort of Puritan voices. He's actually the greatest Protestant poet, I think, that ever existed. And I just want to read the first paragraph of book one of Paradise Lost, just to kind of give an idea as to what you're thinking.
Okay.
Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe with loss of Eden, till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat, sing heavenly muse, that on the secret top of Oreb or of Sinai didst inspire that shepherd who first taught the chosen seed. In the beginning, how the heavens and earth rose out of chaos, or if Sion Hill delight thee more, and Siloa's brook that flowed fast by the oracle of God, I thence invoke thy aid to my adventurous song, that with no middle flight intends to soar above the Ionian mount, while it pursues things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme. And chiefly thou, O spirit, that dost prefer before all temples the upright heart and pure, instruct me, for thou knowest, thou from the first wast present and with mighty wings outspread, dove-like sat'st brooding on the vast abyss and mat'st it pregnant. When in me is dark, illume. What in me is dark, illume, forgive me. What is low, raise and support. That to the height of this great argument I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men. That's one hell of an opening to a poem.
Oh yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, can you decipher it for us?
Yes, it's traditional within epic poems. A lot of people have read the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Aeneid and other epic poems, and there's always at the beginning this sort of great invoking to the muses, to this whatever otherworldly thing, to give your lips and your tongue the ability to sing of these great deeds that were done. And to like let everyone know what happened. And Paradise Lost is an epic poem. It needs to be understood as an epic poem. It is an epic poem, you know, for the first time. And, you know, Dante did something similar, but it's not the exact same. What Paradise Lost, as in the title, literally recounts the fall of humanity, you know, and this is within the Christian context. So I understand there may be some pagan listeners. This isn't like to say one way or another. But this is what this is about. This is for the first time, you know, this Christian story that existed within the Bible, within Genesis and all these other things, is taken and turned into an epic poem by this poet, John Milton. And the key figure, at least for the first couple of books of Paradise Lost, is Lucifer. That's what everyone knows, is that Milton is what humanized Lucifer, is what made Lucifer this sort of figure, you know, sympathy for the devil, the man in the suit who comes up and talks to you like he would talk to anyone else. That all comes from Milton. And that's because for the first three books of Paradise Lost, Freudian slip.
Milton.
Yeah, Milton ensures it that Lucifer is the hero of the story. Lucifer is very much the hero of the story for the first couple of books. And, you know, he's you know, been thrown out of heaven, and he's suffering, and him talking to all of his court, you know, Moloch, Belial, Beelzebub, all these other demons that are in his sort of inner circle, and in Pandemonium, which is actually an invention of Milton. The word pandemonium was invented by Milton, and it comes from two Greek words put together that just means like all encompassing chaos or all encompassing palace of demons. And that was the palace that Lucifer builds in hell after he is flung out of heaven. And basically, you know, just throughout the course of Paradise Lost, Milton recounts the fall of at first Lucifer from heaven. There's a whole story that goes behind that. And then in order to get revenge for that fall, Lucifer leaving hell and coming into Eden, into this sort of paradise that supposedly came from, and causing the fall of humans, this creation that is the reason Lucifer was thrown out of hell in the first place. Because, you know, the reason Lucifer was thrown out of hell isn't because he disobeyed God or anything like that. Lucifer was actually God's greatest single creation in terms of an angel. He was, you know, this is within like the work. Lucifer is the greatest angel that was created. He has the best abilities. He's the most, you know, illustrious, shining image. He's all of the best things of God's creation. And then God creates Adam, the first human, who is just so insanely inferior to Lucifer. And God says to Lucifer, and he says, you know, Adam is better than you. And Lucifer says, well, no, he's not, God. He, you know, I have all of these abilities. I have all these things. And he says, yeah, but Adam is better than you. And he says, well, that's just not true. And, you know, then Michael, the closest to another archangel, steps in and is basically like, no, you're gonna listen to what God has to say. And Lucifer's like, yeah, but this is just an obvious falsehood. And then him and Michael get into a fight, and you see the painting of Saint Michael the archangel banishing Lucifer to hell. This is what's told in Milton's Paradise Lost. But so is the story of the fall of man itself, the fall of Adam and Eve. And actually, there's a scene in it, I think book seven, where the archangel Gabriel takes Adam and Eve up into the top of the mountain, and it shows them the entirety of world history, you know, all of humanity and all of humankind. And, you know, and this was all like Milton was supposedly like sourcing all of these from his like great visions. You know, he wasn't just artificing this. He never claimed he was just writing this as a fictional work. He believed that he was channeling this sort of great work that the Christian God was extending to him. And actually what happens is at the beginning of book three is that, you know, when after he has, you know, painted this glittering image, this alluring figure that is Milton's Lucifer that everyone gets taken in by, who is the hero. He goes blind in real life. He goes blind in his life. Milton goes blind and, you know, is cast into the pits of hell and comes out. And it's actually a gift that he is blinded, because he says in the poem that, you know, God blinded me so I would no longer be taken in. I could no longer see this glittering illusion that was Lucifer. And he would dictate the rest of the poem to his daughter very famously. But, you know, this is what, more than a lot of other things, made Christianity into this grand, epic, dramatic story, in a much similar way that Shakespeare took the pagan history and made it into this grand, epic, dramatic story. Milton did this to the Christian history and turned it into this grand, epic, dramatic story that everyone felt, everyone knew, everyone could see themselves in every position. And at the end of it, it's one of the most compelling arguments for this sort of Puritan Christianity. And he publishes this about the time of the beginning of Cromwell's Commonwealth. And, you know, of course, that goes the way it did. But that's Milton isn't like Shakespeare. If anyone with like a decent IQ or at least an ability to pay attention can pick up Shakespeare and follow it. Milton is the highest barrier to entry of all of these texts, because he makes all of these references. He's done all of this research, and he expects, and he uses all of this high language and this really esoteric and cerebral imagery. And he expects the reader to do the same amount of research, the same amount of work he has done in order to follow along. That makes it the highest investment, but I think of these three texts, it is the highest reward once you understand it, once you can see it, once you read it. I apologize. I've been talking for a while.
No, it's fine. I mean, I'm not an expert on, I know very little about this, so it's just as well that you're able to talk about it at such length. but I am aware that Paradise Lost is full of references to other things, as much as it was a seminal text in itself. I know that it depends on understanding of a lot of other things in theology. So it's obvious that that's going to require a lot of investment. Of course, at one point it could have been taken for granted that the kind of person who would be reading this would be already furnished with that sort of knowledge.
Yes.
So whereas obviously nowadays we can all read books and whatever, but nobody has the... No, very few of us have that grounding in, well, all of that stuff. I mean, a classical education, theology, Christian, Western history, European history, and so on. Yeah. I mean, this is
pagan
a
history. You need to understand pagan history to understand Paradise Lost in many cases.
Exactly. So all of this is neglected now. I mean, and I don't want to go into this because it's obviously a huge thing in itself, but It does strike me as amazing, and this is what Ricardo Duchesne was talking about last night. It is incredible how much we are discarding and leaving to the winds of fate, by neglecting this history and this heritage.
That's completely correct, and you know, and since you know we're all if we're all the English speaking peoples. Right. And our language is our means of expressing ourselves. You know, people have been talking a lot about ChatGPT recently. Right. I don't know if ChatGPT exists in any language outside of English. I've only used it in English. But, you know, these sort of advanced language models, these things are filling a necessity. These things are coming in to fill people's inability to articulate themselves at length. These are coming in to basically make it so that people don't have to think, or people don't have to structure the meaning of what they want to say. They just have these feelings, these urges, and they just want it. They want it sort of expressed in a good enough metric, in a good enough manner, just to have it sort of
made concrete.
Made concrete. You know, and good enough. It doesn't matter the prose of it, the structure of it. None of it matters. If we're native English speakers, you're a native English speaker, sir. You grew up speaking English, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Yes.
I grew up speaking English, you know, even though it's American, it's a different dialect. We use different sort of slang words and things like that. But we are having a completely intelligible conversation with almost zero variations in terms of the word choice, right? In order to be good custodians, in order to properly express ourselves with the language we are both, you know, born speaking, raised speaking, that we understand only like a native speaker. And this is another hard pill to swallow, but it's like Paradise Lost cannot be translated. Paradise Lost cannot be filmed. Paradise Lost cannot be turned into some play. It can't. It cannot exist. It cannot be recreated in any way. ChatGPT can't make it. No language model ever could remake it, because it is the pinnacle of the cerebrality and exclusivity of the English language, as I think the greatest language that has ever been spoken, the most beautiful, the most expressive, the most varied in terms of how you could express different feelings different ways from different angles. And if you are not a good custodian of your language, if you do not understand these esoteric words, if you don't know how to understand them in what context, then Paradise Lost is a door that just does not open to you. And even if you are a native speaker, it's a door that does not open to you. And, you know, I don't mean to get so much into this, but it's like, you know, aren't we right wingers? Aren't we exclusivists? Aren't we like elitists to a certain extent? I mean, you know, in order to understand this great text, to get the great insights, the, you know, all of this sort of understanding, this knowledge from it, you need to have yourself at this advanced level of language that used to be taught in high school, before high school, that used to be taught in like, I don't know what you call middle school in the UK, or...
Yeah, yeah, primary school, yeah.
Yeah, in primary school. It used to be taught there. Like, you turned 14, you knew what Milton was talking about, right? You had that level of language. And it's laziness, it's an inability to take ownership of what is yours. You know, the English language is mine. I grew up speaking it. I know it better than any other language, and I know it more complexly than any other language. Therefore, it is my responsibility to maintain custodian of it, to understand what these words mean, what these phrases mean, what these evocations mean. And it's worth saying
that there is a special pleasure in finding out what these phrases mean, what these turns of phrasing, what that reference amounts to. And then, because once you understand what the reference is, once you know that, once you know what those words refer to, then suddenly that sort of pollinates the whole, it pollinates the greater thing, and you understand it in a whole new light. This is what I got with Shakespeare, because there's one thing they did really well at my school was teaching Shakespeare, because you would go through it line by line, the entire play, and the teacher would explain what this is an allusion to and all that stuff. And of course, they didn't do it. I'm sure that another teacher would do it in a different way. An expert would do it probably best of all. But nonetheless, they had sufficient grounding in the text to do this. And it was fascinating because people think, well, if I don't understand it, I don't mean to caricature, but people tend to think it's difficult. If I don't understand it, then off the cuff, then of what use is it to me? But that's, and I'm not saying this just to sound fancy, but it's exactly the act of finding out what it means that makes it all so rich. It's a wonderful experience. And again, like Romeo and Juliet would be the best example here, mm-hmm. because it was the kind of thing I'm not usually into, and mm-hmm. yet once you understand the mechanics and the references and so on, you suddenly realize just how much of a work of beauty this thing is.
Exactly. And you know, I apologize. I had something else I was going to add to that. It is complete. Oh, I remember. Someone once said to me, if a work is too complex for you to follow, bring yourself up to its level. Don't pull it down to you. by simplifying. One of the things that I think is the most disgusting, I don't know if you've ever, I don't know if you have Barnes and Nobles in the UK, but yes. Yeah. So if you go into a Barnes and Noble, which is the most, you know, the largest bookstore in the world, and you see, you go to the drama section and you see these books called No Fear of Shakespeare. And basically it has the original text of the play on one side, but it also has like a modernized, simplified
and it's
version.
All, yes, in, yes. Yeah. I've seen this online. It's always awful.
It is.
Because they take the life out of the text and they make it sound crap. And you think, how do you manage that? How do you manage to distort something brilliant and beautiful and make it ugly and crap?
It's and that's the thing is like that's, you know, that's one of the things, you know, we complain a lot about modernity and the problems that have been brought about by, you know, the modern age, and whether or not modernity began in 1980 AD or BC, and I have heard both takes that is where modernity began. but you know, one of the best ways to end modernity is to end modernity in your own mind, right? Is to force yourself to understand your own heritage, your inheritance, your language, to bring yourself up to that level, to cultivate your own inner life, to understand all of these references, you know, why a place in the United States is called Zion or Goshen or Sinai or things like that, or you know, Canaan or something like that. The United States has a lot of biblical names of places for this reason. And, you know, understand that. Like, get the reference, get what's being evoked, and then you might understand why the people name that place after that reference, or just simply, just to know it. When someone quotes a Bible passage, you know, and as a matter of fact, someone quotes a Bible passage from, you know, let's say the King James Bible, and there's all of these references, these allusions, and let's say for example this: by the rivers of Babylon there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion, we hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof, for there are they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom, in the day of Jerusalem, who said it, raise it, even to the foundation thereof. O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stones. That's Psalm 137 from the Book of Psalms in the King James Bible. And that's what's often called the Song of Exile. The Israelites have been defeated and they're being taken away from their home by the Babylonians to Babylon. And the Babylonians are sitting there and taunting them and saying them, you know, sing us the songs of Zion. Sing us the songs of old Israel. You know, we hear you people sing songs. You know, we want you to sing us songs. And, you know, they said, you know, how can we sing songs outside of our homeland? You know, when they say, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. That's saying, if I ever forget my homeland, the place I came from, the place I find more beautiful than all other places, then let me never speak again. Let me forget everything. And, you know, that was in what? That was over, you know, nine lines, nine verses, something like that. And the final thing is, it said, you know, that Song of Exile concludes is, it's like, one day we're going to get our revenge and we're going to do to your city what you did to our city. And it's that kind of sort of one for one right now, before everyone goes crazy, you know, me reading the Old Testament, right? You know, look, I don't want to talk one way or another about whether Christianity is a tribal religion or not. I will say I am a Christian. I have been a pagan before. I had a pagan phase before I became Christian. And so I understand why people have that gripe. And that's not what I'm here for. I'm not here to talk about, the spiritual or metaphysical implications of Christianity. I'm here to talk about the literary value of the King James Bible on its own. And the King James Bible, the reason it is the most important version of the Bible ever is that it is the seminal English version of the Bible. And not only is it the seminal English version of the Bible, it is the seminal English expression of Christianity that Milton used. And, the King James Bible was edited by a council of some of the most, wise and learned, supposedly Bacon was on that council, as was possibly Shakespeare, as was possibly a bunch of other playwrights who edited together the King James Bible and translated it from Greek sources, from Aramaic sources, from Hebraic sources, from Latin sources. And they created this, the single most printed and read book on earth, being the King James Bible. And, that is the third text. That is the third role, that it is. It is, the people who settled America were, for the most part, all Christians. There were some little one or two examples you can point to, but this is how they understood their confessional heritage, their faith. Yeah. Right? It was through this King James Bible. And through specifically the structure of language within it. Just that psalm, or if it's something, something in the New Testament, when Jesus Christ says, "Verily I say unto you, all sins shall be forgiven unto the sons of men, and blasphemies, wherewith soever they shall blaspheme. But he that shall blaspheme against the Holy Ghost hath never forgiveness, but is in danger of eternal damnation." Things like that, whether it be this song written by King David or people exiled from Jerusalem, or later on, the Jesus Christ, the Messiah, at least within this story, that is that sort of language, for the first time, this was understood in the English-speaking people's context, in modern English, in a centralized force. A fun fact I tell people that, most English people know, but most people don't know, is that the Anglican Church, the English Church, was not founded by Henry VIII in the 1500s. It was founded by Augustine of Canterbury in the 5th century AD. And for as long as there has been an Archbishop of Canterbury, the Bible has existed in English, in whether it be Anglo-Saxon or Norman French or early modern English or modern English, which the King James Bible is. There always has been an English version of the Bible that the people in England read. And people don't realize that that sort of uniqueness goes that far back, but it does. And, and these are quite literally the inspiring stories, the metaphysic of the English people, post-conversion, post-going into, especially in the world, in the time, in the Elizabethan golden age, especially when the United States was founded, this was the Bible everyone was reading. This was the Bible everyone understood. This was the most cited text by the founding fathers of the United States, was the King James Bible. The most cited text by ministers of parliament, by all of the prime ministers. Everyone knew it. Everyone knew it almost, memorized. This is something inconceivable to a lot of people modern day, but even in backwoods, Baptist poor America, people could recite their Bible from memory, down to the verses.
That's a sort of cliche that everyone knew their Bible.
Yeah, and it's like, and that's because it's like, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to tread very lightly because I understand there's a lot of people who disagree with this and think it's the metaphysic is wrong or something like that. But it's like, this was the animating story of the people, the same way Paradise Lost was, the same way Shakespeare was, and all of that. It's like, this was their metaphysic. You know, even the people who had never once read Milton or never once read Shakespeare, and the lower classes of America and of England always did. They always read their Bible. They always understood their Bible. And, you know, even if you aren't a Christian personally, to say that Christianity isn't what inspired the early settlers of these places is just historically dishonest. You know, even if you think we ought to move on from Christianity, we ought to go to something else. If you don't understand your ancestors as having been Christian, at least for this period of time that America was founded, that, you know, the people of England, the English Golden Age, they left and they founded America, you will never understand them. You will never understand why they thought the way they thought, how they thought the way they thought, you know, what justifications they used in terms of morals, in terms of faith. You know, you will never understand if you don't know this text, if you don't read it.
I mean, this is a thing, you know, even if this was not native to us, and I think largely it was native to us, early, let's say 50%, but even if it wasn't native to us, it's still a phase that we went through. It's still a large chapter in the history of our people. And so it's relevant, whether you like it or not. And I'm not entirely comfortable with it. You know, I'm not a pagan, but I'm not a Christian either. But it absolutely is. I mean, if we were Christian for, let's say, 1,500 years, give or take, then that's really important. I mean, it's not like you can just say, well, that 1,500 years is inconvenient, so therefore it doesn't... you can't just remove that section from the continuum and stitch the two ends together. You know, it's relevant, and it will remain relevant. Even if everyone were to turn non-Christian now, this would still be a highly relevant thing to us all because of its key part in our history.
In our history and in the way that our ancestors acted and how it was inspired. And, you know, that's what I want to emphasize above all things. You know, your religion is your own business, right? I'm not here to preach. I'm just here to tell, you know, I'm here to tell all of you that these people, you know, every single European, more or less, with a couple of very notable exceptions, for the past maybe 1,500 years, like you said, you know, has taken their animation, their inspiration from this text. And there's a reason for that. And if you don't understand that, if you don't know the stories, know that when they were imagining, you know, King David and his Israelites, they were really imagining King Æthelred and his knights. And that's how they always portrayed it in art. They never imagined it as people in the desert. They imagined it as their own version of the promised land of heaven, of all these things. You know, they just adopted the names. In many ways, Christianity was Germanicized when it was taken into Europe, but still, like, the stories were the same. The portrayals were the same. And, you know, even if you do have issues with that, even if you do believe that you ought to move beyond it, you know, this is something, you know, if you don't understand all aspects of where you come from, all aspects of why you're here, then you simply, you know, in order to understand the other two texts, you need to understand this text. You know, if you want access to the greatest pinnacle of English language, Paradise Lost, you need to know the Bible. You know, at least tangentially, at least enough to get the references. You need to know Shakespeare. They make references to all of these things all throughout Shakespeare's plays, right? And this is what culture is. Culture is just a memory. Culture is a memory of what you were, where you have come from, why you have come from there, what these stories are, and why you keep telling them. And really, I think sort of one of the greatest problems we have now in this, you know, quote unquote modernity, this modern day, you know, this time outside of history or whatever, is that we just don't remember.
Oh yeah. I mean, this is a thing, you know, to make a people mad, cut them off from their roots. I can't remember the exact phrasing, but I think there are multiple quotes to that effect, that you deny people access or knowledge of their history, and thus you make them very malleable and nondescript and mad. So, anyway.
Exactly.
Well, look, we'll have to end this one now because the next guest is still waiting. So I apologize that this one started.
No, this is a good ending.
So,
no, yeah. I went through. No, I went through. I went through all three texts that I wanted to go through. I don't have much else to. I don't have much else to say. Other than I guess like a kind of concluding closing thought is that these three texts, in order to understand the soul and the spirit of what you would call the American people, the American spirit, which is really just a recreation, a successor of the English people and the English spirit in this respect, you need to know these texts. If you want to know, you know, Blackstone's commentary of laws and what it's based on, you need to know these three texts first. If you want to know Thomas Jefferson's writings, you need to know these three texts first. If you want to know, you know, shit, the Magna Carta, even, you need to know these, you know, maybe not these three texts, but at least the Bible. You need to know all of these things, right? Otherwise, you will have an incomplete understanding, an incomplete picture. And whenever you have an incomplete picture, that's when problems happen. And if you know the past, you'll know the future.
Yes.
And that's all I have to really say to conclude on that.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to end. As I said, I'm sorry that we can't go on longer because this is all very valuable and interesting. But for now, I will end this conversation here. But this has been a really interesting conversation, Paul. So thank you very much for coming onto Millennial with this topic. It's a very important one, I think. And as I said, this will also have served as an introduction to these three texts for a lot of people. So thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the platform to speak about them. I greatly appreciate it.
Oh, that's you're absolutely welcome. Okay, well, I will be back in a few minutes with Richard Wollstonecraft. In the meantime, Paul Fahrenheit, thank you for appearing on Millennial.
Thank you.
All right. I'll see you very soon.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.